You're listening to the LA Rams Report's Flipping the Tables podcast.
First and 10 from the 27. Warner back to throw. Rainbows the far sideline, and it is caught by Isaac Bruce. Makes a move to the 30, 25, 20, and they won't catch him today.
Yes.
Touchdown Rams!
73 yards for the Reverend Ike.
And now, here's your hosts, Josh Webb and Cameron Worrell.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the second inaugural edition of the LA Rams on Scout podcast. As we said on the previous episode that never aired, because remember, this is the second one, we are working on coming up with a name. However, we cut this episode earlier in the week, and the technology gods basically scuppered the entire episode, which for my money, Cam, I thought was pretty damn good as far as first collaborative efforts go. But before I get ahead of myself, let me introduce my co-host, Cam Worrell, former NFL veteran, current ESPN 940 host, and just about any other thing that you could think of, passing down director, right?
Yeah. Co-founder of Passing Down 2. If people know about the 7-on-7 game in California, that's us as well.
And you guys have a huge event coming up this weekend. We're going to take like 2 seconds to give you a chance to promote that for anyone or any parents who are going to be in the area.
Yeah, it's actually next Sunday, the 28th, up at Chabot College in Hayward, our Northern California regional. You can find all the information on passingdown.com, but we should have 40 teams out there, which will be the biggest 7-on-7 event in Northern California history. So we're pumped up about it. We're coming back down to SoCal March 20th, back in Fontana, and then back up in the Bay right towards the beginning of April. So, yeah, it's passingdown.com to check it out. If you have a club team playing 7-on-7 or you have a high school athlete you'd like to get involved, go check it out.
And for those of you who aren't familiar with Cam, I'll give him this chance to introduce himself sort of a little bit of what he did. As I said, NFL veteran, played at Fresno State, which is how I first came in contact with him. But Cam, why don't you tell your own life story?
Yeah, played at Fresno State. I'm a local guy, grew up in Chowchilla, which is about, 30 miles north of Fresno, a real small town. I walked on at Fresno State, went to Fresno City, came back to Fresno State, ended up playing there, had an all-conference season as a senior, went undrafted, but made the Bears roster out of training camp, played there for 4 years, left and went to Miami for a year, and then came back and finished my career in Chicago. So had a six-year career, got banged up towards the end, but had a nice run. And then came back to Fresno, didn't really know what I was going to do. I partnered in the gym here in Clovis. And then I got involved with ESPN Radio when they got the rights to broadcast the Fresno State football game. So I've been on the Fresno State football broadcast for the last 3 years and started my own show, Killing Time, 3 to 4 every day on 940 ESPN last April. So I've been doing that for almost a year now. I've been on the Fresno State broadcast for 3 seasons. So it's been a fun kind of second career into the media world, something that, you think of one way when you're a player and now that I'm out and I'm in it, think of it totally different. But it's been fun. It's been exciting. It's been a good way to stay involved with the game. And I'm pumped to be on the podcast, man. I'm looking forward to football back in LA and breaking the Rams down and just getting in depth with you and everything we're doing this podcast. I'm super pumped to be a part of it.
Yeah, and it actually kind of ended up working out for us because there were a couple pieces of information that came out about the Rams after we cut the first podcast that wasn't usable. So the first piece that came out, which we'll get to a little bit later in the show, but it was about Alshon Jeffrey, and I cut a video on Scout looking at potential wide receivers for the NFL draft, which we're going to explore in this podcast a little. But when we got to Alshon Jeffrey's name and we talked about him on the last podcast, we basically skipped over the guy thinking that Chicago, there's no way they're going to let this guy walk. Well, reports surfaced today that Chicago is considering letting the guy walk. So we will get to that in a second because I can't wait to hear your impassioned opinion on that one for multiple reasons. But the first thing I want to start out with is we got a bit of news today. It looks like the Rams and the city of Oxnard have agreed to an agreement in place for the Rams to use some facilities in Oxnard moving up for OTAs and stuff like that. It still seems likely that practices will be moved to Southern California, Irvine, just because that's where the Cowboys will be training in Oxnard. So that's a bit of news right there. But let's jump into this Alshon Jeffrey thing, Cam. All right, so let's start with your Chicago Bears love and being a former alum of the Bears. When you first saw Rap Sheet's report on this, what was the first thing that comes to your head?
You know, it's funny because I had communicated with some guys that I played with the Bears who are still in Chicago. And, you know, obviously the big story coming out of the season was whether Alshon Jeffrey was going to continue to be a Bear or not, if they were going to franchise him, if they were going to try to work out a long-term deal, what the possibilities were of all those things. And initially guys were kind of unsure. You know, it never helps when a receiver like Alshon Jeffrey, you know, underperforms in a contract year. And that's what he did this year. He had some injuries. He only ended up playing in 9 games, but it's a very underwhelming performance heading into being a free agent. So their initial thoughts were, you know, I think it's maybe 50-50 whether he comes back or not. And then as the offseason kind of progressed, it became maybe more apparent, or at least thought of to be more apparent, that the Bears were going to lock him up or they were going to franchise him to try to work something out. And now we get this report today that the Bears might let him walk, which, I mean,
they have,
I guess,
to be testing public opinion with this report,
I
right? That's
think,
the only only explanation for doing this. Like, let's see if the fans would give a damn.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they're trying to gauge what kind of market Alshon Jeffrey might have early. You know, I don't think that I really don't think they're going to let him hit free agency. I can't imagine they're going to do that, because that's a pretty big risk. Alshon Jeffrey might not be at the very top of the wide receiver as far as number one receivers go in the NFL, but he is definitely going to be the number one free agent wide receiver if he's allowed to hit the market. So I think they're getting some early word out, seeing what the reaction is, and then kind of formulating their game plan off of that. You don't let a guy like this walk. I know he was banged up last year, but there were times where he was the best wide receiver in Chicago, and Brandon Marshall was lining up on the other side of him. This is not a guy that just shows up on your roster. They drafted him in the second round. There were a lot of question marks around him coming out of the draft, if he was overweight, if he was lazy running his routes, and he's performed like, you know, close to a number one receiver the entire length of his career outside of last season where he was banged up. So I think the Bears are getting an early word out, putting some feelers out there, seeing what the reaction is, because I can't imagine they let him hit the free agent market, because someone's going to overpay for him. Someone with a lot of salary cap room who needs a receiver is going to overpay for him, and the Bears are going to end up losing a guy that could be their number one receiver for a long, long time.
Yeah, this just seems like, you know, and I was talking about this with a buddy of mine, you know, in reference to Manchester City with bad business. And for those who don't follow soccer, which I would understand, there was a deal that took place this last summer with Manchester City and a club in Spain by the name of Valencia. And what ended up happening is that the previous year, the club in Spain had they have loan there where you can loan out players. It's a big cool system if they put that in the NFL, loan a guy out for a year. But they have this loan system in European soccer where you can loan a guy out. But a lot of teams will structure a deal where it's a loan that the team has to buy the player at the end of the year. They might not have the cash up front, but they should, in theory, by the end of the year, and this is a way for teams to sell players under the auspice of a loan, since the team buying them doesn't have the money right then. One of the players that Manchester City had loaned was on that they have to buy deal, and he was going to have to get sold for, I believe the club was going to be responsible for paying like $23 million for the guy. Well, the guy had a crappy year, didn't have the year, basically the same thing that happened with Alshon Jeffrey just didn't have a repeat of the, you know, the good seasons he'd been having. And so the other club was like, you know what, we don't want him. And Manchester City was like, well, you know, that's tough because we signed a deal. So you have to buy him. And what ended up happening is that not only did Manchester City not make them buy him, they actually paid Valencia something like $45 million for a defender. They made this guy the world's richest defender so that they could get their own money back. Like, they paid Valencia $23 million extra over what this player was worth just so they could get that money back, which I have never understood that as being... I don't even understand how that works in business or sports. But this is, it seems like this would be the second worst piece of business that I could think of, letting a guy like Alshon Jeffrey just walk. That would be tantamount to that. You're like, we're just going to do business against ourselves. Is that what would be going on there?
That's what it seems like, because, you know, if you allow this guy to hit the market, teams are going to look at, you know, the other number one wide receivers who have hit the market the last couple of years, take into account the jump in the salary cap this year. And, you know, the Bears have $54 million or $58 million, depending on where the cap is going to be, to sign guys. So you throw a franchise tag on Alshon Jeffrey, you ensure nobody else can offer him a deal that he's going to jump on the first 5 minutes of the free agent signing period because someone throws $40 million guaranteed at him, and you work out a long-term deal. Or if not, you have tons of room under the cap. You make him play under that one-year franchise tag and prove, one, he can stay healthy, and two, he can be that number one receiver for Jay Cutler without Brandon Marshall, without a Martellus Bennett in his prime, without Matt Forte catching 80 balls out of the backfield. You make him prove it, but you can't just let this guy go. You can't let him hit the open market. Receivers like Alshon Jeffrey never hit the market. They are never just free agents. They're either franchised or the team that they are currently with works out a long-term deal before they allow another team to come in and swoop on them. You just don't see this happen. I can't imagine, like, maybe 2 months from now we look back and say we were totally wrong. The Bears let him walk and he signed a deal with, you know, the Rams or the Minnesota Vikings or whoever. I can't sit here and see that happening. There's no way the Bears do that. I think they're trying to gauge the market to see exactly what they're going to have to pay him if they want to go long-term with him. They want to try to get that done before. If not, they franchise him and try to work it out after. But I can't imagine you let this dude hit the market. There's no way that this guy is a free agent when free agency opens.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree there. I think that, as you stated, this has to be a situation where the Bears are seeing what the early response is. You put these feelers out. You kind of get a gauge of teams like the Rams, who we've said they need a wide receiver. They don't have that guy on the roster right now. You go through, you look at their roster, maybe the most veteran receiver that they have on there, a guy that maybe you could possibly in another lifetime maybe call him a number one, Kenny Britt, though I don't think that that would ever be a title I would give Kenny Britt. But that's like... The Rams need that threat. They need that guy lining up and saying, okay, we defenses have to honor this guy. Now, the Rams have a lot of speed. You know, Tavon Austin comes to mind, Todd Gurley, you know, that's more at the running back position. But Tavon Austin is a guy that they'll use a little bit more versatilely. And Stedman Bailey, prior to his horrific shooting incident, you know, he's a great compliment, obviously, to Tavon Austin, even going back to their days together at West Virginia. When you look across the landscape of some of the available receivers, if the Rams were to go out and not get Alshon Jeffrey, but if the Rams were to go out and grab one of those free agent receivers, if I put a gun to your head and say you have to pick a second off that list, who would you pick? Like, there's no other choice. You have to pick a second off that list. Who are you going to go with?
Man, that's tough. I would I don't think there's another number one wide receiver on this list. I mean, you think skill set-wise, maybe Percy Harvin is that guy, but he looks like, from the outside in, have been a cancer everywhere he's played. When you have that type of skill, you don't get shopped around like Percy Harvin has. So, you know, skill set wise, maybe if you put a gun to my head, I would look at the list and I would say maybe Marvin Jones from Cincinnati, maybe Travis Benjamin from the Cleveland Browns. But, you know, Travis Benjamin, you're talking about making an investment into, you know, a still young wide receiver, a 26-year-old guy, but really didn't have a ton of production until this last season. And he's a little bit of an undersized guy. I don't know if you want to make a big investment in a guy who doesn't really fit the ideal physical makeup for the position. There are obviously exceptions, but it's tough to do that. And Marvin Jones is a guy who's extremely skilled. He's an extremely skilled athlete, played well in Cincinnati, played, you know, second fiddle to A.J. Green, which makes a lot of sense because A.J. Green's one of the best in the business. But I think he's a guy that can take a big step forward if he gets put into the role of, you know, being a number one receiver. If you game plan for him and you put him in specific spots where he can be successful, I think he can be a very good number one wide receiver. But there's nobody on this list, nobody that is going to hit the market that can make it the impact that Alshon Jeffrey can make. And I don't think he's going to hit the market, but if he does, like, he's the only guy I think that you can seriously look at on this list and say, we can build our passing game around this guy. Other guys are good. They're complementary pieces. I think they can be successful if they are guys that you base things around, but they cannot dominate coverage. They cannot dominate a defensive game plan like Alshon Jeffrey can.
And when you say dominate a defensive game plan, I think it's too easy. I think that when you look at guys like Odell Beckham, certainly Megatron, you know, certainly Fitz. These are guys that, you know, when we say take over a game, these guys make it look easy. They make it look effortless. I mean, whether it's their ability to shuck defenders and toss them aside like they're nothing, whatever it is, you see the body type. You see it coming out of college. I mean, you knew it was there with a guy like Sammy Watkins. You mentioned A.J. Green. When Juju Smith goes pro, teams are going to be all over him just because of the physicality at the receiver position. You know, how would you define a dominant, game-changing NFL receiver? Like, if you were to draw one up on paper, maybe using some brief measurables, what types of things are you looking for? Because you had to go against these guys. I mean, you know what it's like to be there. What was your biggest, I don't want to say worry because, you know, I don't think you can play the game with fear, but yeah, at a base level, I guess it would be a concern. When you were lining up across from guys, there had to be one or two guys where you're like, this isn't going to end well.
Yeah, I'm Randy Moss was that guy in my time in the league. I mean, he was the guy who could run every route. He didn't look physical, but he was 220 pounds. You know, he was 6'4". He was strong. He was physical. He could get off of contact at the line of scrimmage. And then, you know, he had as good a speed as any receiver I've ever seen, played against, played with. You know, I played with Devin Hester. Randy Moss's long speed is as good as anybody who I've ever seen on a football field. So when you take all of that into account, the fact that he's a big target, the fact that he runs precise routes, the fact that he has great hands, he can go up and get the ball, and he has that great deep speed. I mean, that's kind of the prototypical receiver. If I'm looking for a guy that I build my franchise around at that spot, he looks like Randy Moss. Long speed, can go up and make catches, is physical, can do everything you ask. You think about the best receiver in the NFL right now, it's Antonio Brown, and he is by far, I mean...
Are we putting him ahead of Megatron?
Right okay. Now, he's the guy. Right now, Antonio Brown is the best receiver in the NFL, but he is so unprototypical. I mean, when you look at him, you don't see a true number one receiver. And that's why, hey, it took me time. You know, I wouldn't admit that he was the best receiver really until this season, just watching his whole body work. He is so precise. He can accelerate in and out of breaks. Like, I don't know if I've seen a receiver with the type of acceleration speed that he has getting in and out of his breaks. And it's so precise. He runs excellent routes. He's not big, but he's physical. So that he may be the exception, but you're talking about a number one receiver. They have to have some height, you know, ideally 6'1" or above, 200 plus, a guy that can, you know, has that deep speed that is a 4'4", low 4'4" guy, and has the type of acceleration that Odell Beckham has, or Antonio Brown has, or AJ Green has. You know, they have that in and out of break precision, not just that they can run precise routes, but they can get in and out of those breaks. They can decelerate and accelerate with the best in the business, because that's what it takes to truly dominate defensive game plans. And Randy Moss was, you know, T.O. was a guy, you know, when I played, Randy Moss was obviously probably the premier guy when it came to this, that if you didn't specifically move coverage to him, he was going to beat you every time. He was going to win one-on-one matchups consistently. So you had to send extra coverage. You had to double him, or you had to roll a safety over the top. And that's what I mean when I say dominate a defensive game plan. You have to make a defense change what they do to account for your unique skill set. And when you look at the list of free agents, there are not guys that can do that outside of Alshon Jeffrey. Maybe Marvin Jones can develop into a guy somewhat like that, but you're not talking about a guy that scares defenses outside of Alshon Jeffrey. Those guys just aren't there. I know Travis Benjamin had a great year with some subpar quarterback play in Cleveland, but I don't think he consistently can be that guy. It takes a special receiver to be productive even when defenses game plan for you. You have to be the best of the best to be able to do that. And Alshon Jeffrey, I think, has the ability to do that. And nobody on that list has that ability outside of him.
And, you know, it's funny you mention that, because that I think is so true even at the college level. And a guy that we're really familiar with, you know, currently plays, you know, stay in the NFC North, plays with the Packers, and Devontae Adams. And, you know, Devontae, when he first got going with Fresno State, there wasn't a whole lot that any defense could do to stop that guy. It's just a matter of the Mountain West not really having people out there on a weekly basis that could shut down an NFL wide receiver, because that to me is what Devontae always was. How he ended up a two-star guy, I think I understand, but based on pure talent alone, I think that in a more modern era of recruiting, a guy like Devontae ends up with at least three or four. I don't think that he slips that far again if that happens. But when teams doubled him, there was a period in his career, and I know that you watched it, where, you know, you talk about it taking a special receiver. He wasn't just able to not take over those games. He actually started to get really frustrated, and it wound up somewhat becoming detrimental to what Fresno State was trying to do on offense. I mean, you could even, if you wanted to, throw around the term poor attitude. But he got a reality check, and he sort of regained what it was that he wanted to do moving forward, and that's when he started to reassert himself. But you even look at a guy like Devontae, who was so ahead of everyone else in the Mountain West when he played, you know, even New Mexico could cause frustration with that guy by rolling those coverages, double-teaming him, and really forcing even an NFL quarterback like Derek Carr, who, you know, we both think should have been a first-round guy, and certainly playing like he should have been a
right.
first-round guy. And you know, Derek Carr couldn't even do much about that. And Derek Carr could throw open any receiver in the world if he wanted to at the college level. There was only about one or two things Derek Carr couldn't do at the college level. And you know, I'm not sure that they're worth mentioning on this podcast. But his ability to get that ball to guys was second to none, in my opinion. And even he couldn't do much with Devontae because defenses were so concerned with taking him out of Fresno State's game plan. They knew that if they could do that, they stood a much better shot of winning that game. And that's the kind of stuff that you're talking about, right? Like, the ability to do this week in and week out without getting frustrated, not only at yourself, but at what defenses are doing. How much of a receiver's mental makeup is getting over that hurdle of what the defense is throwing at you, as opposed to maybe what you aren't doing technically right? Because there's sometimes where, and I realize I'm going a little long here, but I just want to make sure this thought is clear. I think there are sometimes where we as human beings get in our own way more than what other people do. And we hear that in press conferences when guys say, well, it wasn't anything they did.
Right.
And fans get that weird look on their face like, BS. And it's like, well, no, it's true. Look, he's not taken away from what they did, saying that he got in his own way because of what they did. And I get that. I mean, is that even your experience? Is that fair? What are the things that you find stifle receiver development at the NFL level?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. Just think back to Odell Beckham and Josh Norman and how frustrated Odell Beckham was with that matchup and what Carolina was doing to him. It takes time for receivers to develop being that true number one in the NFL. I know Odell Beckham just came on like gangbusters last year and had another solid year, had another, you know, Pro Bowl season this year. But it takes time to develop that. And some guys have it. I think Calvin Johnson came into the league saying, I'm bigger and faster than everybody else. You do what you want to do. I'm going to still continue to dominate defenses. I think it takes a very special guy to come into the league with that type of mentality. I mean, there are very few guys that I think can just walk onto an NFL field out of college and feel that way. Larry Fitzgerald was one. Calvin Johnson was one. Randy Moss with his rookie year was one. But there are always, look, defensive coordinators in the NFL are smart. You see these young receivers, or maybe you see young quarterbacks have a stretch of success where they really look like they've really taken some steps forward, and then you get defensive coaches looking at what they do well, and they take it away, and now those players have to adjust. And the really good players, they find a way to adjust, and they become the same dominant player that they were. Other players are not as good as they appeared in a short stretch of time, and they don't really ever get back to that status of being a truly dominant player or being a quarterback like Nick Foles, who went 29 touchdowns and 2 picks and appeared like he was going to be one of the greatest efficiency quarterbacks in the history of the NFL. When defenses catch up, it's tough for a player that doesn't truly possess the skill set and the mindset to be able to bounce back from something like that. So we see receivers all the time get frustrated. I think Dez Bryant gets frustrated a lot at himself, at what a defense is doing to him and how he is not able to defeat it right away. But Dez Bryant has the makeup where even if you shut him down for 3 quarters, that 4th quarter, he's going to figure out a way to get it done. Or you shut him out for a game, the next time you play him, he's going to make some adjustments and figure out a way to get it done. So, you know, I think using Devontae as an example, Devontae Adams last year as a rookie really played well the last half of Green Bay season and in the playoffs, had an excellent postseason as a rookie. Second year, all the offseason talk is that Devontae was the MVP of OTAs. He looks great. He's taken a real step forward. Well, what happened? Their true number one, Jordy Nelson, goes down. A true number one receiver goes down. And now Devontae is thrust in the position of being that receiver that defenses game plan around. And he's not ready. He was not ready in his development. And I'm going to give him a little bit of a pass because he had an ankle injury early. And I don't think he ever really got back to full health. But it's different when you have to be that guy. When you have to be that number one guy, it's totally different than if you have a guy like Jordy Nelson on the other side. And I think we saw Devontae struggle with that at times. Not physically, because physically we've seen what he can do. He matches up with anybody. But mentally, making the mental adjustments that are necessary to be that guy. And there are very few guys that can do it. Very few guys who have that mental capacity, not just to not get frustrated, to continue to be confident even when you're getting shut out, but to make the adjustments necessary by what you're seeing post-snap or pre-snap to make the adjustments and be on the same page with the quarterback to be successful. It's a rare quality, and only, you know, a handful of guys have it, and that's why they get paid, you know, 13-plus a year to play receiver.
No, I think that the mental aspect is really a perfect segue to what we were looking at last podcast, and that's draft prospects. Because for our money, it seems more likely that the Rams are going to find success in the NFL draft with a receiver than maybe a quarterback. The quarterback's its own separate conversation, and we have our opinions about how the Rams should attack that. But staying with the receiver list, if you're looking at this list and putting a checkbox next to guys who you say, when it comes to the mental makeup, a guy who can step in, because not only do the Rams really need a number one receiver, they need a guy who can step into this offense right away. You know, they might be able to bring a quarterback along or get away with playing a rookie quarterback, but their offense had 11 touchdowns last year. That's, by comparison, the New England Patriots had, over, I think it was like 36. I'm pretty sure that Baylor had 11 touchdowns in one game last year. I don't know.
Probably.
I didn't watch enough. Didn't watch enough of them. But the mental makeup is something that I think is going to be key for the Rams when they're looking at draft guys, because whoever it is that they take at that receiver position is going to have to come in, and whoever the quarterback is, that receiver is going to be expected to get on the same page with them fairly quickly. Now, I think that really whittles down the list of draftable players at the receiver position for the Rams, because now I think you're looking at a different type of ask when it comes to these receivers. You're not saying, hey, we want you just to come in and catch the football. We need you to come in, be a leader right away, and really step out there week in and week out and show these guys how to do it. You know, offset the talent that we do have. This will give Gurley a little bit more room to grow next season, as opposed to defenses loading the box, knowing that the Rams really only have him as an option. I think if you don't get a receiver out there, not only are you shortening the shelf life of Todd Gurley, but you're basically ushering in your own termination if you're Jeff Fisher. Which receivers on that draftable list have that mental makeup that you think they can do what Fish is going to ask them to do, what Fish's mentality is going to be when they get to the NFL?
You know, I mean, I think that's a very tough question, because, you know, I think teams that are going to meet with these players, you know, the Rams, teams that need receivers, you know, the 49ers, all these teams that are looking at these guys, they're going to sit down with them and they're going to get a good sense of who they are as people and how they may translate mentally to the NFL. When I look at receivers making the transition from college to the NFL, I think a few things that you look for in a receiver really stick out when you watch the way these guys handle themselves in college. The number one guy on this list to me, as far as just having the mental makeup to be a number one receiver in the NFL, to handle everything that is thrown at him in that regard, is Braxton Miller. Braxton Miller was the leader of the Ohio State Buckeyes as a quarterback, you know, an all-conference quarterback, Big Ten Offensive Player of the Year as a quarterback. It takes something special to do those things as a quarterback, much more so than just being a number one wide receiver in college. I mean, there are guys with that makeup at that position, but it takes a special dude to lead a team like you, like Ohio State, in the way that Braxton Miller did. And then to understand the situation he was in after getting injured, moving to receiver and, you know, looking like a guy who had played there his whole career. So mentally, I think Braxton Miller is at the top of that list. He's a leader. He's mature. He's gone through a position change and handled it tremendously well. He's been, you know, for 4 years now, the face of Ohio State, and he handled that really well. So Braxton Miller would be the guy I would put at the top of that list. And, I don't think Laquon Treadwell has been that guy. He's a guy who disappeared at times in college. Corey Coleman is a guy who played in a simple system in Baylor, so I think it's tough to just put that on him. I think the one other guy that we're talking about, you know, being a possible first-round guy would be Will Fuller, the receiver from Notre Dame. I mean, a guy who played with a handful of different quarterbacks in his career at Notre Dame, never had a dip in production regardless of who was at that position, a guy who took every challenge a defense threw at him and usually – got the better of those matchups. And he's a guy with that mental makeup that can walk into a locker room, can step on the practice field day one and say, I'm the best receiver here. You're going to have to respect what I can do, or I'm going to light you up. Those two guys to me, just mental makeup wise, are the guys who jump off the page when we're talking about guys who can do that.
And, you know, one of the things that I love about Braxton Miller, it was in the letter that he penned to Ohio State fans through the Players Tribune, which, if you've not read that, I recommend you go and check that out. You know, a lot was made out of Miller, out of you know, his DUI incident and whatever. I outside of don't do that, you know, I don't put much stock in that as far as an somebody using it as a way to assail Miller's character. I'm not going to get behind that train. I think it was a bad decision. You know, I think he would even tell you that. I think he would definitely do things differently if he had the opportunity to. But with the list of things that I have seen dudes accused of in college and the types of behaviors they've had, Manziel, man, if you want to put down a list of warning flags, you know, those are the things you look for when it comes to that phrase, warning flags. You look for actions like those. Braxton Miller made a mistake. A mistake to me is different than a warning sign. And Miller, for all of the crap that came with him for that, one of the things that got completely overlooked was when you mentioned he got that injury and he took a view of the landscape at Ohio State. And while everybody else in the nation was speculating, oh, Miller's going to be gone, he's going to transfer, he's going to do this, he's going to do that, Miller had already contacted Cardale Jones and JT Barrett and told them, I want to make that transition to wide receiver because I know what's coming. And I know that if I don't make this move, it's going to make life a heck of a lot more difficult for all three of us. And frankly, the only thing I've ever wanted to do in my life is play for Ohio State. So it seems to me that I know what's coming, and I know that I can make that move a lot easier than some of these other guys. And while everybody else in the nation was speculating about which of these three Ohio State quarterbacks were going to transfer, most likely it being Braxton Miller, everybody at Ohio State knew that these two guys, Ohio State had already made up their mind. Miller was going to be your new receiver, and these two were going to battle it out for the quarterback spot. And that, to me, is a defining example of the leadership that you're talking about. When a guy is able to look at a situation, assess it so introspectively and honestly, and say, you know what, I realize what this is about to bring forward, and I'm going to avoid it. I am just going to avoid it because I have the confidence and belief in myself that I can make the move for the good of the team because that's what the team is going to need. And he did it without being asked. He started the process. He initiated it. That's not just acting like a leader. That is showing leadership. That is embodying leadership. And that, to me, just it stands out so much when I look at a guy like Braxton Miller and I look at a guy like Will Fuller and I see that same stuff, man. These two guys, for my money, have to be the safest. I hate that term in the NFL draft, but is that fair to call them the two safest picks?
I don't know if Braxton Miller's safe, you know, simply because of this. He looks great as a receiver in 1 year at Ohio State. Obviously, he's raw. Obviously, he has a ton of work to do to get himself to being the true number one receiver, because I think he can become that in the NFL. But, you know, this is a guy you're going to have to put a ton of time into. He's going to have to develop much more than he has as a route runner, catching the ball, you know, away from his body, going up at the point of attack and making catches. Those are the types of things you have to do at the NFL level that Braxton Miller is going to have to develop. He doesn't have those skills right now. So, you know, I think mentally, yeah, Braxton Miller is as safe as they come. I mean, I think you look at this draft, and I don't know if there's a safer guy than Braxton Miller with his history, with everything you just described, his role at Ohio State. But, you know, he's going to be a little bit of a project. His athleticism is off the chart. I think you put him in the slot right now, he can dominate nickel cornerbacks that he's going to face, and he can get open almost every play. But there are a lot of things about playing that position at the NFL level he's going to have to learn. But Will Fuller, I think, can step on the field right now. You're not going to worry about him whatsoever. He has all the physical skills. He has all the tools to be that guy. And I think with the way he's made up, he can be that guy. So, yeah, as a receiver, Will Fuller is probably, as you said, the safest guy, the guy that you can expect to not, you know, be that floor as far as his potential go, where some of these other guys, you know, Laquon Treadwell, probably number one on that list, might be. He's probably the safest guy if we're talking about receivers.
And I'd like to apologize to poor Braxton Miller. It's JT Barrett with the DUI. And when I said it, I don't know if it sounded right, but keeping track of that three-headed hydra up at Ohio State was damn near impossible. And props to Urban Meyer for handling that situation far better than I think I could have. I wouldn't have known what to do. I mean, talk about an embarrassment of riches, man.
Yeah, and I think Braxton Miller, I mean, he made that situation easy. Just like you said, he's the one who went to this coaching staff to make that position change. He didn't make somebody, you know, force this three-headed monster to get broken up or make somebody transfer because it was going to be, you know, a competition that was going to be too hard to figure out. He did that. He helped Urban Meyer, one of the greatest college coaches in college football history. He helped his job be much easier this season. And it takes a very big guy to be able to do something like that.
For my money, I actually argue, and I know that some people won't want to hear this, but I would actually argue that Urban Meyer is actually the best college football coach in the business. I know that honor goes to Saban so many different times, but I look at Saban and I look at Meyer and I look at what Meyer's done at every single stop. And Saban has done it in the SEC. And he stayed where he's comfortable. Urban Meyer did it at Bowling Green. He did it at Utah. He did it at Florida. And now he's done it at Ohio State. And fortunately, that probably means a West Coast school is next on the list for Meyer. So maybe that means good things for Oregon, UCLA, or USC down the line, because he seems like a guy like a Jose Mourinho who's destined to coach all over the globe.
You bring up a good point. Utah, I mean, Bowling Green before that, Florida, Ohio State, there aren't many guys who have done that. And look, if we have a 14 playoff, you know, Utah back in the day probably is in that 14 playoff as a quote-unquote mid-major when Urban Meyer had them undefeated, I think it was 2005. I mean, they're in that discussion of being a true national champion contender. Who has ever done that in a mid-major? Nobody.
And keep in mind that this is the same Utah team, and it was Whittingham that coached it, but this is by and large a byproduct of the work that Meyer had done. That was the same Utah team that ended up clubbing Alabama when they played them in the Sugar Bowl. That was, I think that was the last we ever saw of that.
Yeah,
it was the 2004 that Utah had the undefeated season because they were tied with Auburn and USC that year in terms of undefeated. And Lord knows that many USC fans have had debates with Utah fans and Auburn fans about that one. But you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about receivers and virtually no time talking about the guy who's going to get the ball to the receiver for the Rams. Last year was who knows. The year before that, it was who knows. This has sort of been what the problem has really been for the Rams, I would say, since Bulger left. And I'm not even sure that Bulger was the answer post-Kurt Warner, but Bulger at least gave you a stability that I don't think the Rams have had, either due to injuries or just freak circumstance or whatever the case may be. But I always thought the warning signs were there with Bradford. I didn't think Bradford was going to have this pronounced NFL career that other people did. I figured he was maybe, to a lesser degree, a sort of poor man's Jason White in that, you know, I've never had much faith in Oklahoma quarterback frames in the Bob Stoops era. Like, I don't know what it is about those guys, but they just don't seem to hold up after a certain amount of time, and maybe that's just the game in general. People are falling apart a lot faster, but Bradford to me never really felt like he was going to be that guy. He had all the talent in the world, but I never saw it, and I don't know why. I can't explain it, but I just didn't. And now, as you mentioned, and we've made fun of, Foles comes over, and that's not really any better. So now where do the Rams go from here? What's next on the agenda? You've got maybe Peyton Manning out there in free agency, depending on what he decides to do. Maybe he wants to put a year in Los Angeles. I can't see Manning doing that of his own volition. I think that would be something like the league would help massage along. But it seems like it's slim pickings out there for quarterbacks and receivers right now in the free agent market, which basically leaves the draft pool, right?
Yeah, you know, we know that quarterbacks don't hit the market. And if quarterbacks do hit the market, they're not usually guys that you can expect to be a true franchise type of a quarterback. So when you're talking about quarterbacks, you always have to start with the draft. I mean, there might be some guys who, you know, were career backups who maybe could be, you know, a 1 or 2 year kind of fill starter. But I mean, the Rams have those guys on their roster. Case Keenum can do that. You know, they went through that last year. I don't think anybody associated with the Rams wants to go through what they went through last year at the quarterback spot. So, look, I wouldn't sign Peyton Manning if my life depended on it to be a quarterback to lead me to wins at this point in his career. I know he just won the Super Bowl, but that was not because of him. I mean, that was despite of him. They had the Denver Broncos had the lowest offensive output in the Super Bowl of a Super Bowl winner ever, and Peyton Manning was that guy all season long.
And that includes Ben Roethlisberger's super crappy game against the Seahawks, man.
Right. I mean, it was a historically poor offensive performance, but they won. Peyton Manning should just write off like Jared Allen did on Twitter, just write off and go start owning Budweiser, you know, distributorships and all that stuff that he wants to do, own 85 Papa John's. Just do that, because I'm not building or expecting Peyton Manning to come in and do anything for me next season. You know, there's chatter about Chase Daniel. He's going to be a free agent, you know, possibly being a fit in Philly because Doug Peterson really thinks he can be a starting quarterback in the league. But you're not going to find guys on the free agent list that can do it. You're just not. Kirk Cousins will probably get franchised or they'll lock him up. You know, Brock Osweiler.
Recent reports yesterday with Cousins seem to indicate that the contracts have stalled out with him in Washington. I was reading something yesterday that they appeared pretty far apart, at least on what they wanted, and that a deal seemed unlikely. I mean, we know that can change on a moment's notice, especially with Washington and their decision making. But let's just pause here for a second and say, if Kirk Cousins isn't locked up, is that truthfully the best option on this? Or maybe you're looking at his teammate RG3 and saying, this could be something that we could look into as well.
If I think of Jeff Fisher and how he wants to run his offense and who would fit what he wants to do better, it's Kirk Cousins is that guy. I know RG3 might have the higher ceiling. I mean, we've seen RG3 at his best in the NFL. It's better than what we've seen out of Kirk Cousins at his best in the NFL thus far. But we've also seen RG3 way, way underperform compared to what we've seen Kirk Cousins at his worst. Jeff Fisher, when you think about historically the teams he's put together, he likes to run the ball. He has one of the best running backs in the league in Todd Gurley. He had an offensive line that was decent last year, even though they were banged up. And I think if he had his choice of those two guys, he's going Kirk Cousins because he's much more accurate. He's much more polished as a pocket passer. And he fits that play action style of offense that the Rams run. Now, RG3 and Todd Gurley running his own read, if RG3 could stay healthy, could be very, very scary. But Jeff Fisher does not want to do that. I think he wants to have a pocket passer who can run a pro offense the way he wants to run it, with a downhill running game and a play action pass game, and beat people like that and playing solid defense. So I don't know who, if both of these guys, as far as RG3 and Kirk Cousins go, get an opportunity to be a starting quarterback again in the league, will be better, but I think the better fit for St. Louis, the better fit for the Rams in LA is Kirk Cousins, based on what Jeff Fisher likes to do.
And I think that you mentioned a really excellent point there, because as I look at the Rams and Fish, you know, we talk about, and we hinted at this on the last podcast about, you know, what Fish needs to accomplish in order to keep his job moving forward, which, to be honest, doesn't really seem likely, nor do I think that you or I really expect him, with not just the schedule that they have, which we can talk about in a minute, but really with the lack of playmakers they have at quarterback and wide receiver, it's going to be a daunting task for Fisher to even put together a record that would say, okay, after four straight meetings, or five straight at that point, we still think that you're the guy to lead this team in L.A. If for whatever reason, Kroenke and management or whatever decided that what they wanted to do was bring in a guy like RG3 and get that marquee quarterback, is there not an element of that that is almost setting Fisher up to fail? Like, at a certain point, you are forcing him to go so far outside of his comfort zone that the learning curve for the both of them would really just be, well, why don't we get this over with and just fire him now? You know, like, you're not going to get the record that you're probably hoping for if you ask Fisher to do that. Is that an unfair statement to make?
I think if Stan Kroenke and you know, the executives at the Rams want to do that, bring RG3 in, and they're dead set on that, then yeah, you're punching Jeff Fisher's ticket out of town. Not only because I don't think RG3 can come in and fit what the Rams do right now and have success, but, you know, they're not going to succeed this season, and Jeff Fisher's not going to be happy. He's not going to be happy if he's forced to put RG3 under center next season and go to battle with a guy like that who doesn't really fit his philosophy whatsoever. And, you know, you think about a coach who, you know, seemingly has a great relationship with the people above him within the organization. If they do something like that, I think it's pretty clear to everybody involved that they're looking at RG3 being an answer and Jeff Fisher not being that answer. We're going to bring RG3 in, and as soon as Jeff Fisher, you know, is done in 2016, as soon as the season's over, if we don't have success, we get rid of him and we bring in the coach we want to develop our system around RG3 and Todd Gurley. I mean, that, I guess that's possible.
You wouldn't do that now. Like, if you were going to do that, it feels like this is something you should nip in the bud and have the guy in there. You're essentially wasting a year with RG3 and the Rams. Like, literally, you're throwing it away. He's not going to get that year back on his career. You could even take a couple off the end of his career, depending on what happens, as you said, with the Rams' decent offensive line. So you go ahead and do that, and you've thrown away the entire season for the Rams, at least 1 year off of RG3's career. And now Fish looks all the worse for wear and basically is now starting to have the perception of a head coach who really hasn't been worthwhile since the mid-2000s. And I'm not sure that helps Fisher at all either moving forward. It feels to me that if you do that, you may as well have brought in the coach from the very beginning that was going to be able to see out that plan or execute that plan to the standards that you're expecting, right?
Yeah. If that happens, then yeah, I think it's fair to say that for sure. That if you're going to make that move, you might as well have already got rid of Jeff Fisher and brought in the coach you feel like could have success with a guy like RG3. And if they are dead set on doing that, you're right. I mean, unless something happens that I can't really foresee, you know, Jeff Fisher figuring out a way to run a system that fits what RG3 can do well. You know, I don't think RG3 fits a pro-style offense, and that's all I've known Jeff Fisher to ever run as a head coach. So if that happens, you know, you're right. It would be a waste of a year. It would stall the Rams organization, you know, taking that step forward of trying to be a playoff team and really making an impact in L.A. So if that happens, I mean, maybe Jeff Fisher can work with him, but it seems like if that happens, that this year is kind of for naught. You get rid of Jeff Fisher and move on.
So then the question becomes, and I realize we're running a little short on time here, and it's unfortunate because it's the quarterback position, but we beat it to hell last time, so I figured it'd be more fun to beat receivers to hell this time. What do you do? Because the name most commonly associated with the Rams at this point is Paxton Lynch at that number 15 spot. I see Paxton Lynch. I like the build. I like the frame. I like the fact that, you know, even though he played for Memphis, I think Fuente is a he runs multiple different looks. I think that there is a reason they beat Ole Miss. I think there is a reason that he was one of the most sought after coaches in the country at one point, and people were considering him for a lot of Power Five jobs. But I see a project. The only real project on that board that I do not see is a guy by the name of Jared Goff out of Cal. Any other guys on there that you think stand out in any way, shape, or form? Because if I'm looking at CBS's list, and we did this last time, I'm liking some of those guys maybe from the 5 to 10 range more than the 1 through 5 range. I think that come combine time, a couple of those names are going to jump up the list. Do you happen to agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, if Jared Goff is there at 15, I think he's a no-brainer. If Jared Goff is there when the Rams pick in the first round, I think Jared Goff is a no-brainer. You jump on him as quickly as you can. He's a California kid. I mean, I saw this kid as a sophomore at passing down, and he had the same touch on the ball that he has now. He had the same quick release. He had the same super cool, you know, demeanor that he had, that he's shown at Cal. I think he's going to be an excellent NFL quarterback, especially if he gets to play somewhere like L.A. You know, if he goes to Cleveland where, you know, he's never really experienced that type of weather on a consistent basis, it might be a little bit of a different experience for him. But he stays in Cali. I think Jared Goff is a surefire starting quarterback, will be a great fit with the Rams. And if he's there at 15, then this conversation is over with. Now, I don't know if he's going to be there at 15, and I don't think, and we touched on this a little bit last time, that Jeff Fisher has the makeup to jump up and draft a quarterback in the first round, to give up picks to move up and draft a quarterback earlier than their original pick. But I think there are guys on this list, and I don't know if there are guys outside of Jared Goff that can jump in and start in 2016 in the NFL. But you have a lot of very talented quarterbacks. You have a lot of quarterbacks that have had a lot of success in their career, and you have some guys who would be very good value. You know, talking about the combine conversation, I think Christian Hackenberg from Penn State, the guy with the physical skills, 6'4", 230 plus, coming into the season, he was the number one quarterback on that list. I mean, he was the guy that everybody thought would be a surefire number one overall pick. And he got his head beat in at Penn State last year because they couldn't protect him whatsoever. But he's a guy, I think, when he gets in the classroom with organizations, he's going to really, really impress them. He ran a pro system at Penn State. I think he is ready to step in and be a quarterback, maybe not as a starter in 2016, but he's a guy that you can build a franchise around in a couple years. The other guy who I think is really, really intriguing on this list, and another guy who I think at the combine is going to blow the doors off of people, is Cardale Jones. And we saw him come in, step in for Braxton Miller, then step in for JT Barrett 2 years ago and win a national championship with Ohio State. But 6'5", 250, can stand in the pocket, can move a little bit, is physical when he has the football, and has probably the number one arm in this draft as far as velocity, as far as throwing a deep ball. Like, he has an absolute cannon.
Which is saying something, because I posted a GIF earlier this year of Jared Goff covering about 50 yards in, like, 1 second with a throw. So the fact that you're saying Cardale Jones has the bigger arm is really saying something, because Goff's arm is something special.
Yeah, I think Cardale Jones is, he has an all-time arm. I think that's what, when I see him throw the ball and what he can do, and I'm not saying he's an all-time quarterback or that he's going to develop into that, but as far as arm goes, he has the livest arm that I've seen come out in a long time, and that says a lot. And I don't want to compare it to the last guy who I think his arm reminds me of, because...
Yeah, I know,
you know
where you're going
I'm
with
not
that.
Say
I know exactly
him.
Who you're
gonna...
thinking of, too.
He was that impressive coming out, and Cardale Jones, his arm strength reminds me of that guy. But he's going to be a guy, when he throws at the combine, people are going to see the velocity, they're going to see, you know, the type of arm strength that he has, and he's really going to, I think he's going to test well, he's going to run well, he's going to, I'm sure, bench well. He's going to do everything that the combine says is going to translate to the NFL. He's going to do all that well. And I think he's going to jump up boards. If you have him as a fourth or fifth round pick right now, I think he'll end up being a second or third round guy for sure when this whole process is done. I think that's kind of the ceiling that he has. So those two guys really, and you know, we can go on this list. I think there are some other quality quarterbacks that will move up as well, but just jumping off the list, those two guys to me are two of the top guys who are going to move throughout this process.
Yeah, I'm with you on Jones for a number of reasons, and I think that you know the tempting comparison will obviously be to Marcus Russell, as we were hinting at. That's the super tempting comparison for a lot of people just because of the sheer size of them, just the way they can physically. I mean, when Cardale Jones lowered his shoulder, like it didn't matter if what he did to Reggie Ragland, you know, I mean. Jones wasn't having any of Alabama either, and it doesn't get much more physical than Bama in college football, and he just ran them over like they were just kids, mm-hmm. just trucked them. You know, but I think that when it comes to Cardale Jones, I think that there are several things that he has going for him that I don't think Jamarcus did. I never saw the drive in Jamarcus that I've seen in Cardale. This is a guy who people forget, man. Cardale Jones was easily the oldest of those guys in that three-headed Hydra that Meyer had, which another way to translate that is he'd spent the most amount of time on the bench. Nobody even really knew who Cardale Jones was mm-hmm. until that, you know, that magical run that he had. And that's no knock on Cardale Jones. That's just saying where he had been at in the Ohio State pecking system. And Cardale Jones not only didn't settle, I mean, he needed some opportunity, but in football, in sport, you can only do what you can do. And when your opportunity comes, you have to grab it. And I don't think that anybody could have possibly done more to grab their opportunity than Cardale Jones. You know, Ben Roethlisberger came up just a game short, you know, on that 15-1 Steelers team of sort of being that novice guy to lead a team to an improbable title, you know, and then Cardale Jones comes along and largely does what most people considered impossible. And I think that what that says about his character and his determination is already more than I ever saw out of Russell. Because, you know, from the moment that Russell was drafted, he played hardball with the Raiders. You could kind of tell right away that his mind was not on the football field. It was at the bank. And I think that with Cardale Jones, his mind has always been on the football field. And I feel like that arm, like you mentioned, my God, those two can just throw a football like you would not believe. It is just... And you know what? For my money, too, I think Max Brown is going to impress a lot of people with his arm this year for USC. Because that, I mean, there are just some dudes in college that when they rip it, it's just uncanny how far and fast that ball could travel. But Jones and Jamarcus are easily at the top of that list. I think Jones is destined for better things in the NFL.
I agree, and just real quick on Max Brown, I saw him a couple years ago when Fresno State went down there and got boat raised. He came in relief of Cody Kessler, and he threw a slant, and I was like, yeah, you can see right away why this guy was competing with Cody Kessler a couple years before, because he is big and he can rip it, man. It's one throw for me to say, yeah, this dude has an NFL arm, and I'm really excited to see what he does down at USC, but I'm with you. Cardale Jones finds that vertical play action system. Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I didn't mean to compare him to Jamarcus Russell. I just meant he had a strong arm like Jamarcus. I think Joe Flacco is the guy he reminds me of as far as being a big pocket guy who has an excellent vertical arm who can play in that play action system. Not everybody can play in that system where they turn their back to the rush, and they stand up and they throw a dime on the sideline, you know, that travels 40 yards. It's difficult to do. Joe Flacco's that guy, and I think Cardale Jones is kind of a similar quarterback when I
both
see
guys
him.
Like 6'6", too, right? I mean,
yeah,
Joe Flacco's a big dude.
Right, both big physical guys, and Cardale might be a little more athletic, but, you know, I think he can stand in there and make those types of throws. He's going to have to develop. He has not played a lot of football, and he's played in a system that doesn't necessarily translate to the quarterback he's going to be in the NFL, but I think he has a very high ceiling, and he's a guy that can develop into a very, very good NFL quarterback.
It's funny that you say that stuff, and then your mind's eye starts maybe like replaying old clips that you have stored in your memory. And as you were talking about Joe Flacco turning his back and then, you know, basically hitting that erect stance, looking downfield and just uncorking, I just flashed back to when Cardale Jones was on that run, and he would do that exact same thing. I mean, he would have his back disrespectfully to the Alabama front seven, just disrespecting that front seven, turning his back to them. And then he would turn around, look at them, and run them over. He just, it was disrespect on disrespect on disrespect. And if you're a guy that loves to watch physical quarterbacks hand out a beating to defensive backs, it was basically a villain's wet dream. Like this, it was magical to watch. And after you mentioned that Joe Flacco comparison, I started replaying like just them snapping the ball in my head. And it's crazy how similar they are now that you mentioned that comparison, just watching them. Both guys have just that really, they don't struggle for posture. You know, I'm a really tall
right.
guy. And, you know, you've been around Ryan too. Ryan's a tall guy, but we just kind of like walk and are just kind of like casual with what we do. When Cardale Jones and Joe Flacco enter a room, you know it. Like, they are standing above everybody, chest puffed out in the air, and exuding a confidence that I wish I had at that size.
Yeah, and he does that in the pocket. He stands in the pocket like that. His chest is puffed out. He's looking downfield. He is not worried about, you know, somebody coming and making an impact on his throw.
Is he tempting if you're Fisher? Because he kind of reminds you of another guy that Fisher found a tremendous amount of success
yeah.
with.
Yep. Steve McNair, right.
Yeah, do you make that move? I mean, if you're looking at that and say, okay, I may not be around to coach this guy, but if the Rams truly brought me over here because they value my opinion, I think this guy right here, if we can get him, you know, maybe even in the third round, which I don't think he'll fall there, but just – you know, let's just say if Derek can go in the second, Cardale can go in the third, all right? If he makes it to the third round and you're Jeff Fisher, do you just not hit the you know, go to Les Snead? Do you not go to your owner and say, look, man, we need to get this kid? You know, I may not be around to see through his development, but I know talent. Steve McNair was a Hall of Fame quarterback. This guy can do what he did. You just have to put him in a position to succeed. Is that something you could see Fish doing?
That's something I could definitely see him doing. And I think that the Steve McNair comparison is good as well. Steve McNair was the same guy. I mean, he could stand in the pocket and deliver throws seemingly off his back foot like we've seen Cardale Jones do through his short Ohio State career.
Pure pocket passer too, man. Pure pocket passer.
Yeah. And you know, Steve McNair could bow up and he could handle, he can hand some punishment to some guys too when he needed to. So I think if this dude's there in the third and you haven't gotten a quarterback, I would think it's, you know, it's probably a no brainer. Now, there could be other guys that really intrigue you, but you know, you look at Jeff Fisher's track record and we've spoken about how he likes to run his offense. To me, Cardale Jones fits that. He fits exactly that style, and I think he could be really successful in the NFL in a system like that. So, yeah, third round.
I want to run a scenario by you. I want to run an imaginary scenario by you because I started thinking about this after we had that first Lost podcast, and I was thinking, you know, so we both love Miller, and both of us think that Cardale Jones, with a little bit of coaching, because – well, he just didn't have the experience that some of the other guys in this draft will have, that Cardale Jones could develop into something special. So what would you say if I said that rather than taking a quarterback in the first round, if I'm the Rams at 15, assuming Goff's no longer there, rather than forcing the issue on a guy like Paxton Lynch, which may or may not work out, and then you're really back in the same position that you were, mm-hmm. what if you took a guy like Braxton Miller as your receiver, and later on down the draft, you took a guy like Cardale Jones as your developmental quarterback, and then worst-case scenario, if you're the Rams, well, I think Braxton Miller can do a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. you know, he may be projected as a receiver at the next level, but if you wind up with the amount of injuries that the Rams have had and deficiencies that they've had at that, you know, a guy like Braxton is going to be a challenging option for any offensive coordinator. I doubt there's a guy who's at least not going to look at some tape, even if it's just an hour of tape, before he goes to bed at night saying, I wonder. Just popping it in and saying, I wonder. I feel like with Braxton Miller, you could possibly end up with two very serviceable options. And then if you get a guy like Cardale Jones in there in the third round, you're not taking a first-round chance on a guy like Lynch. You're able to develop him, and he's already going to have somewhat of a rapport with a guy like Braxton Miller. The Rams already did that crap with Tavon Austin, and then they went out and got Stedman Bailey. There's got to be some truth to connecting these guys with battery mates, man. You know, Chip Kelly was somewhat fond of doing that stuff in Philadelphia. Now, argue you want how that went down, but it's not like NFL coaches aren't embracing the idea of pairing guys with some battery mate that they had at the collegiate level. And I can't help but think that that wouldn't be a fun solution. I don't know if it's practical, but it would be fun.
It would be fun, especially when you think about, you know, we don't know a lot about Cardale Jones other than he won a national championship in relief, came back to school, you know, was a spot starter, started, then JT Barrett started. We know a lot about Braxton Miller and about his makeup. So pairing a guy like Cardale Jones, who doesn't have a lot of experience, who hasn't had to be a leader for an extended amount of time, and having to take that step up to the NFL, it would be a big bonus for a guy like Cardale Jones to have somebody like Braxton Miller, who he knows, who he's comfortable with, who he's been with for, you know, 3+ years to make that transition with. I think if you take Braxton Miller and you have him on your roster and you need a quarterback and you have a guy like Cardale Jones who ceiling is as high as anybody in this draft as far as his physical tools go, then yeah, I would totally see them, you know, thinking about the possibility of pairing those two guys, because you have Braxton Miller, the leader, the success that he's had, and you pair him with a guy like Cardale Jones and they can both make that transition together. I think it would help both of them be successful in the NFL, and I think it would shorten that learning curve for both of them when they make that transition.
Well, we have run a little long. I've got one last kind of like brief question here, because I ran this article about the scheduling, and then we'll wrap it up with, you know, where they can find us on Twitter and what we've got upcoming. But, you know, I was going through, and CBS, we know what the opponents are. We don't have the official schedules yet in terms of actual dates and where things will be slotted. But with the Rams, it's not going to be that hard to project, because the NFL traditionally has given teams a bye week after they play a game in London, and the Rams are scheduled to play that game in London this year. So we can be pretty sure that their bye is going to be that last weekend in October. So this, I mean, aside from the ridiculousness of their schedule in drawing the NFC South and AFC East, not to mention two unpredictable teams in Detroit and the Giants, you know, you look at that schedule and you say, okay, the Rams don't get a bye until week 8. Now, that could be a good thing and a bad thing, because your bye basically comes at the most worthless time in the season. But in this rare instance, the bye actually comes at an optimal time for the Rams, because you'll be 7 weeks into the season. At that point, I think fish is going to be what fish is. You have to know by that point if he's going to be your guy, and if he's not, that gives you an opportunity to can him, replace him with an interim, or maybe even just outright hire a guy, depending. And then you have that last week before the NFL trade deadline on November 3rd to sort of address what ails you. When you see the setup of the Rams' schedule, do you think that could be a bonus to them, or is that just kind of, I don't know, man. I mean, what are your thoughts about that schedule?
I think a bye at that point in the season is always good for, you know, a team. You hate to have a bye like week four. You know, if you have a bye, you know, week 10, that's beneficial too. But yeah, the Rams, I think at that point in the season, you'll know a lot about them, because even though we don't have what their exact schedule is going to be, you know what teams are going to play, and there are not a lot of easy wins on that schedule. So you're going to know a lot about them, and I think you're going to have some decisions to make. One, if you do draft a quarterback and he's not Jared Goff, maybe he's not Carson Wentz at 15, you might have to make a decision about where you're going to go that second half of the season as far as who your quarterback is. So I think at that point in the season, there could be a transition. And whether Jeff Fisher is there or not, I think depends on a lot of things. I think number one in that is he has to win. I know the NFC West is tough, their schedule is tough, but if he doesn't win, I don't see him surviving 2016. And if you feel like at that point in the season that Jeff Fisher can't do more than, you know, go 7-9 or go 8-8 and put you right back in the position you're in right now, picking in the middle of the draft, no real playoff possibilities, but no top five pick either, then I think you think about making a move. You think about inserting the guy you drafted within the system that he's been comfortable with, or you start to move the offense around what his skill set is, and you move forward that way. So I think for the Rams and the way that they're built right now, I think the bye week is perfect. Maybe they're, you know, maybe they're 6-1 at the bye. Maybe they're 5-2. Everything is great. You get a week off. You just beat the Giants in London, and you really make that push towards the second half of the season and making the playoffs for the first time in a long time. But I think either way, however this season goes, it's a good place for them to be in, you know, week 8, being able to look back on about the first half of the season and make a decision for the future of your franchise. It could be a big one. You know, it could be we're moving on. We're moving to the future. We're putting our drafted guy in there, and we're going that way with a new coaching staff. But, you know, it could be that they really feel like they're on the right track and they can go towards the second half of the season.
And, you know, in wrapping up here too, I would also add on to that, you know, as the way the NFC West is going to shake out this year, I don't think anybody knows. You know, I looked at the Seahawks last year, and I didn't really see that same physical dominance that we'd seen out of them. Maybe they captured some of that toward the back end of the season. But the product that Carroll's putting on the field right now reminds me somewhat of the product that he was putting on the field at the back half of his USC career, in that it is a damn fine product. And if you were a coach of any team in the league or, you know, in the nation, you would want to have that product. But the problem is that with what he has done with his previous products being so good, it doesn't measure up. And Carroll is a guy that gets comfortable, I think. And I think Carroll's far more about having his setup the way it is, and then the wins are just sort of a byproduct of that. I've always found his philosophy is really being the root of his success, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You know, tons of coaches, historically amazing coaches, got by with their philosophy because that's really what matters. But there is a level of comfort with Carroll that I do see with the Seahawk team, and I'm not sure if they're on the decline or if they're just getting started again. I don't know. I don't know what to make of Chip Kelly. I don't know if his, you know, first season with Philadelphia is really what you should expect from Kelly in the NFL, or if that was the aberration and now, as you said, teams have adjusted to what he likes to do and have taken it away from him. I don't know. I do know that we could reasonably expect the Cardinals to probably be pretty good, but if something happens to Carson Palmer, then we can expect the Cardinals to be in the exact same boat as the St. Louis Rams. A terrifyingly good defense with a laughably impotent offense. So if you are the Rams, next year could theoretically be all to play for or nothing to play for. And in I think that bye week in the middle of the season presents an interesting set of options. for them. But we have gone on long. Why don't I give you the chance to tell people what you got coming up, Cam, and where they can find you on social media if they have any questions.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter just at Cam Worrell, Worrell, two R's, two L's. I'm on the air in the Central Valley every day from 3 to 4, but you can also hear that online at 940 ESPN Fresno. .com. So you click on the link. I'm on there every day. We also have some, you know, podcasted interviews and segments. You can check it out. But Cam Worrell is a Twitter. You can find me on Facebook, Cameron Worrell, which is my actual full name. But yeah, that's mostly personal stuff. I do put some radio stuff on there, but Cam Worrell, the Twitter, is where you can get most of the info. I retweet a lot of the interviews and the podcasted art segments, so you can check them out there. Other than that, man, I'm keep doing the radio thing, keep doing these, you know, keep these rolling, and I think these are going to be fun as we continue to delve into the LA Rams and all the possibilities. And you're right, just real quick, you know, now the NFC West could take a step back. The Seahawks could have to get rid of some pieces. You know, Marshawn Lynch is not there anymore. You expect Rawls to be the dude, but you never know. That offensive line was a mess for the first half of the season. So, you know, they could take a step back. You're right, without Carson Palmer, the Cardinals are, you know, the worst offensive team in NFL playoff history. So,
Where's your thought process on Chip Kelly, man? I'm curious. Like, what do you think that first year with Philadelphia is the real Chip Kelly, or do you think that maybe the problems that he was having with Lurie and such toward the end of his run there is what NFL Chip Kelly is destined to be?
I think his overall philosophy, how he wants to run his organization, I think can be really successful in the NFL. And I think that first season was a byproduct of that. Now, I think he got into trouble in Philly because he brought pieces in that did not work. Jordan Matthews didn't work. Nelson Aguilar, first-round receiver, didn't work. He got rid of established guys and tried to replace them with younger, cheaper talent, and it didn't work. Maybe it would have worked in 2016 if he was still there, but we'll never know. So I think he can be a very good NFL head coach, but he has to have the pieces that fit his system. And I think that's where he's going to have to start being a little bit more flexible. You know, you can't always have the guys who are going to do everything.
Does he finally got that guy in Kaepernick? I mean, I feel like Kaepernick as a quarterback is closer to anything he had at Oregon than any dude that lined up under center in Philadelphia.
Yeah, if you're talking straight quarterback, I thought Colin Kaepernick was going to end up in Philly last year, you know, with Chip Kelly. So as far as quarterbacks go, I think he fits better than anybody in the NFL as far as what Chip Kelly wants to do. But Chip Kelly has a way he likes to run things. He did it at Oregon. He got that power in Philly where he likes guys to buy into everything that his organization did. You're going to have to live with some guys who aren't going to do that. And I don't think, you know, LeSean McCoy and DeSean Jackson, I don't think they wanted to do everything Chip Kelly wanted them to do, and he got rid of them. He's going to have to learn how to deal with some of those guys who aren't going to totally buy into everything you want them to do to have success, because I think he can have success. I think his systems can work. I think the way he runs his organization can work. He's just going to have to find ways to work better with elite NFL stars and guys who, you know, look, not everybody's a saint in the NFL. Not everybody does everything exactly how they should. You're going to have to deal with some of those guys, and you're going to have to find out a way, you know, find a way to win with them.
Yeah, I always laugh when I read people say that, you know, Kelly, you know, his gimmick was figured out in the NFL. And you know, I hear that word gimmick tossed around with Kelly a lot by uneducated minds. And it leads me to believe just that, you know, they don't really understand what he's doing. Because if Chip Kelly is anything but a gimmick, his stuff is very much based on fundamental power run concepts. You know, people see that Oregon team and they think it's a light them up, throw the ball all over the field team. And no, that is not what Oregon was doing. Oregon was running the ball right down and over your ass.
Right.
Constantly up the middle, up the gut, hitting you in the heart of your defense and really demoralizing you to the point where they then could throw the ball basically all over the field because you were trying to spend so much time and energy to beat Chip Kelly's mathematically sound scheme that you didn't have the energy then to expend on the back half of that field because you'd been having to come down and crash the box. I mean, he stretches defenses so thin with his offense, and to me, it's never been a gimmick. It's always been something that was meant to hit you at the heart. It's meant to wear you down. It may look a little different, but it's honestly no different than what David Shaw does at Stanford. It is just a demoralizing offense built around a power run set to wear you down over four quarters. And I think that, you know, the 49ers are set up in a place where they're going to need pieces for sure, but they're a young, exciting team. And, you know, Colin Kaepernick has – there's not enough being made of what the Niners have on that offensive line, man. Marcus Martin, for my money, is one of the most underrated players in terms of offensive line abilities. I don't think he gets his just due for what he does and how intelligent he is. And it's odd to me that USC running backs and quarterbacks get all the praise coming out, but it's really their offensive line
right.
that found the most success in the NFL. If you look at guys like, obviously, Tyrone down there at Dallas, who, you know, made himself a nice payday a couple years ago.
And best tackle in the NFL right now.
Yeah, and then you've got the Tate, and then you've got both Khalil brothers, who are,
right.
you know, obviously doing fairly well. And then Marcus Martin up there. I think that Chip Kelly has a lot of young and exciting pieces up there in San Francisco. And if he can get Colin Kaepernick's ego and just rein him in, as you say, and bring him in under that umbrella, I think that that's a guy that he could really showcase to the NFL. Okay, look, I've always said I do not want a running quarterback. I want a pocket passer who can run. That is what he has always, you know, the paraphrasing there. But Kelly has always stated his preference is to have a guy who can throw the football down the field and is a little athletic. And Kaepernick is just that, man. And that guy has a live arm. You talk about live arms during this show. The dude can throw a 95-mile-an-hour fastball. It doesn't get much more live than that. He just hasn't really found that consistent success. And I think that that's where Chip Kelly is at his best, is that he creates consistency. Everything with him is about doing it on a schedule, on a plan, and getting it down to a routine. And if there's one quarterback in the league who I think can benefit from that more than anybody, it's Colin Kaepernick. If he can get things down to a routine and start understanding things at a base level, his talents are such that it would be terrifying to think of what his ceiling could be.
I think Colin Kaepernick fits that description perfectly. I mean, the big arm. Even last year, you look at his deep ball statistics were as good as anybody in the NFL. Even though it was a limited sample size, he has all the arm talent that you would want, and he's a very, very good athlete. He fits the size, kind of prototypical size of a quarterback that Chip Kelly always kind of likes to have. So I think he's going to fit perfectly there. Now, you know, he's going to have to make some strides in his development like I thought he was doing a couple years ago when he took the Niners to the Super Bowl. But, you know, I think Chip Kelly hit a home run, not just going to San Francisco, but having a guy like Colin Kaepernick waiting for him when he got there. And I think he's going to figure out a way to put Colin Kaepernick into positions to have a lot of success up there. That's what I think. I think it's a perfect fit. I mean, we'll see if he's a guy or not, but I really think that it's going to be a good fit for those two guys.
Well, it's certainly going to be something interesting to watch, and as OTAs and mini camps begin to get underway, it's the intensity and the excitement for football, NFL football, in Los Angeles is going to return, man. And I'm kind of glad that you're going to be my Sherpa on this guide, dude. My love has always been the college game. Those who have followed me on Twitter know that that's always sort of been my passion. But this is just such a unique opportunity. And there are only so many times in life that you are asked to cover an NFL team by a respectable media outlet.
Right.
I don't know that there are too many times you can turn that gig down. But it's so refreshing to me, at least, that I know I'm going to have an NFL vet there sort of, as somebody that I can be like, hey, am I thoughts too weird here? Because I'm going to bring some college game to this podcast, man. And it's going to be nice having somebody who not only deals with the recruiting side of things, which is great. You like the total package. You understand recruiting. You are completely familiar with the college game. And then you're also on air for 940 in Fresno, so that means you have to know the Niners, and by virtue of that, their divisional opponents. Like, this is, you talk about me being put in a perfect situation, you know, I feel like I'm, I don't know whether I'm Chip Kelly or Colin Kaepernick in this situation, but I feel like I have been put in the perfect situation to succeed.
Well, I think we're going to have a lot of fun, man, and I appreciate the opportunity to do this. You know, I've only covered Fresno State. I've only been on the air here in Fresno. And, yeah, we talk Niners and we talk Raiders, but that's largely been what I've covered. So just like you, I mean, the opportunity to do something like this with an NFL team in L.A., I think it's, we're going to have a blast. I think we're going to bring some different perspectives to – you know, what people normally hear on an NFL podcast. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun for people. And, you know, I'm sure we've been pretty much on the same page these first couple podcasts, but I'm sure we're going to reach a point where, you know, you're going to be steadfast in your arguments. And so am I, and we're going to have a lot of fun kind of battling that.
I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. I'm so looking forward to that. It's gone too well up to this point. You know, we need where it's really going to separate, man, is when we get down into the nitty gritty of the season, and I'm going to be trying to land base the defensive coordinator. And as a former defensive guy, you're going to be right there.
I'm going to stand up.
You're going to take that sword and you're going to come back charging full steam. And it's going to be awesome. And I'm going to have to be prepared for it, because this means that if I'm going to try and win that argument, not only am I going to have to outwit a former NFL player, like, I'm going to have to outwit somebody who is built to understand NFL schemes. And that's an exciting challenge for me. And I don't think I'm going to be able to do it, but I'm going to give you my best shot, sir. Like, I'm going to bring my A game.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. And you know, it's fun for me. I bring one perspective. You know, I will totally admit that I am biased, you know, towards defenses, towards players and their perspective on a lot of things. So for me, it's fun to talk with and argue with somebody who comes from a completely different background, who has covered, you know, different you know, parts of the game, and who understands different parts of the game differently than I do. So it's going to be a lot of fun for me to, you know, get your perspective on a lot of things and how you think of them, because I think of them totally differently. And I'm admittedly biased in that, and I will never back down from that. But it's going to be a lot of fun, man. I'm excited about the season. I'm glad the Rams are in LA and we're able to do this, because I think it's going to be a blast. And hopefully, you know, people enjoy listening to us for an hour or whatever it ends up being, because I think it's going to be a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, I completely agree, man. And just one final thought. One of the things that I think is interesting that, you know, media outlets are starting to embrace, and I'm sort of glad that we got off on this note, is I think it's always helpful on podcast, and maybe I seriously am not massaging this podcast. I realize it's an example of it, but I always think it's super helpful when you have somebody on one side of the coin who is really looking at things from business, administrative, like, but they understand what goes on the field and have empathy for player situations. Because I've always been about the kids in college, and there's a level of that translates to protecting players in the NFL as well. But you need to balance that, I think, with somebody who has that locker room experience, because there are things that I feel like they shouldn't, they don't make sense to me on an administrative level. But when I've talked to people who've been in there and been in those situations, they were able to provide me with insight that really I hadn't considered. And I get those aha moments. And I love those aha moments, because that means you're learning something useful.
Right.
And hopefully I have plenty of those on this podcast, because I'm reasonably sure there's going to be like 10 times where I'm like, yeah, but so-and-so, and you're going to be like, actually, and then I'm just going to be sitting there going, huh, well, that sucked for me. So I think there aren't enough podcasts out there that really take advantage of that, where the guys aren't afraid to be wrong on them. And, oh, well, damn, I did not realize that. This business is always about being right, and I enjoy being wrong.
Yeah, look, I was having a basketball conversation on the air yesterday, and kind of our basketball expert here in Fresno came in and kind of schooled me. You know, I had a certain, or at least I thought I had a certain understanding of how Phil Jackson likes to run an offense, and he kind of came in and said, it may appear like that, but this is really what he wants to do. And I thought, okay, man, you're right. And then he totally came in and set me straight. And it's nice sometimes when you have somebody like that who sees things differently, and in the end you can realize, like, man, I think he sees things more like they really are than I thought I did. And then it was refreshing. It was a cool segment. I think people enjoy hearing stuff like that because, you know, you are getting a differing of opinion. But sometimes one dude is just right and the other guy is wrong, and sometimes it's just a conversation with no right or wrong, and different perspectives always bring that. And I think it's going to, like I said, it's going to be a blast to do.
For sure. And I can't wait for the next one, which, what are we setting for that? We stuck with, was it Tuesdays or Mondays that we decided?
I think Tuesdays. We stuck with Tuesdays. Tuesdays are much easier for me. So yeah, we decided Tuesdays and get them done.
Yeah, we'll have them up about every Tuesday. So one of the things that we'll start doing is I'll set up a mailbag for us. And you know, obviously, as the season goes on, man, I think what we'll try and run, at least on the back end of this podcast when the season starts, I think would be something cool, is to sort of really at least break down, I think, one or two, or maybe even possibly three plays. You know, you could take two on the offensive side, two on the defensive side of the ball. You know, just key plays, key moments of that game, and then really just spend a little bit of time breaking them down from an X's and O's standpoint. I think that would serve two purposes. One, I'm always thirsting for X's and O's knowledge. Like, I feel, as a guy who didn't play the game at any particularly high level, I played basketball because of my height, you know, it's always awesome to have access to that information that's put in a digestible form. But I also think it makes for riveting listening, man. And I would be super curious to hear you diagnosing plays if you're down to do that, when the season starts.
Oh, I love that. I love that, man. I get the NFL Game Pass every year and I sit at my computer and I watch coaches' tape. I mean, that's what I do during the season. That's what I enjoy doing. I'm a football nerd in that regard, that I like sitting around and watching tape. I don't watch games in the NFL to root for a team or watch players. I just watch how the game goes, and that's what's fun to me about the game of football now. So I love diagramming X's and O's. I love breaking down why a play worked and why, you know, a defense maybe broke down. To me, there's nothing funner than that. So, yeah, I'm totally looking forward to that. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I think we will add a lot of insight to why the Rams are successful or why they are unsuccessful. And it really comes down to X's and O's and execution. And it's going to be fun to dive into that once the season gets rolling.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I'm ready for the season to be here now.
Me too, man. Get down there in LA and watch some of these Rams games and just really see, you know, the path that this organization is going to be on, you know, as an LA team and beyond 2016.
Dude, you want to know what's going to be the most super exciting thing about this? And this is just from, like, a pure, like, I love state-of-the-art crap. The Rams are going to have the most state-of-the-art facility by the time this is all said and done properly.
Right.
Because that's the way the dong measuring contest of stadium building goes in the NFL. And when that stadium is unveiled, that is going to be a choice walkthrough for the media.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, Stan Kroenke's putting up his own money. So if I'm a billionaire and I'm putting up my own money to build something, it's going to be the best the world has ever seen, and nobody's going to be able to question that. So it's going to, there's going to be some sweet digs whenever that thing's done. I don't know when, but whenever it gets done, it's going to be a fun atmosphere to go to.
Well, on that note, we will end here and say that we will catch you guys next Tuesday. Like I said, I will get that mailbag set up, and if you have any questions for myself or Cam, let us know. And as I'm sure as the season gets underway, you know, that the audience will pick up, the questions will start rolling in. And if you guys have ideas for segments, be sure to let us know. As for myself, you can find me on Twitter at Fight on Twist. You can also follow the site on Twitter at LA_RamsReport. And we are also give a shout out to the site publisher and the guy who sort of gave us this opportunity, Mr. Ryan Abraham. Big thanks to Ryan. You can follow him on Twitter at Inside Troy. And man, if you haven't already gotten over there, be sure to head to the site laramsreport.com and get signed up now. It is going to be fun. Any last anythings?
No, man. I'm looking forward to diving into this team and diving into the landscape of the NFL in 2016. It's funny because there's no games for a long time, but the combine's next week. The free agency opens after that. The draft is after that. Then we have off-season workouts. We have all the franchise tag stuff. So it's just a nonstop reality show with the NFL, and it's going to be fun to get into all of that. And then, to me, the best part about it, just diving into the X's and O's. So I can't wait for all these things to progress and to be able to get on and talk about them. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Underwear Olympics next week, man. So. And we will be sure to have a podcast special on the Underwear Olympics. So keep it locked right here at LARamsReport.com, your source for Los Angeles Rams information on the Scout Network.